Our group would like to welcome our speaker tonight, and that is Mike from Lambertville.
Good evening, everyone. My name is Mike. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi.
First off, I want to thank you all for asking me to come out here and speak to your meeting. It's an honor to get asked to speak at an AA meeting, and it's a special privilege for me to get asked to speak at an AA meeting because it was an AA speaker that carried the message to me. It was a young man who came to my civilian alcohol class, and he carried the message to me, and I don't know his name. I never met him again. I don't even know if he's still sober today. But I know that the trajectory that my life was on 5 minutes before he spoke and the trajectory was on 5 minutes when he was done was two totally different places, right? And he had no idea probably the impact he had on my life sitting in that audience at that time. And I don't claim to think that I'm going to save someone's life by coming here and speaking to an AA meeting, but maybe in a small way I can give back to the debt that I owe to that young man and AA as a whole. And so it's always an honor to come speak at an AA meeting, which is one of the reasons I always wear a tie when I speak. I have a job today, so I need this for work, but it's out of respect, as I was told in early sobriety, out of AA, to come and clean yourself up and put on a tie is saving your life. The old-timer who told me that actually pointed at me when I asked him about it, because he had been speaking at this meeting on the second floor of this old church in Dover, Delaware, when I had about 2 years sober. And he said, and I asked him, I said, listen, thanks for speaking, but why are you wearing a suit and tie? It's 100 degrees up here. Because I was 22 at the time. I got a lot of wisdom, you know. And he pointed at me, literally, he said, it's out of respect for AA, young man. And then ever since, I always wear a suit and tie whenever I speak. And so I am happy to be here. And my sobriety date is October the 10th, 1996. I've been sober 18 years, which really is a miracle. The longer I'm sober, the more of a miracle it becomes. One thing in AA that I have become more comfortable with is the fact that I'm a deeply flawed person with very troubling defects. And somehow, despite all that, I still don't drink, which I can't explain. I think a lot of people in AA sometimes they get caught in what Bill Wilson calls spiritual pride. That is, they've been sober a long time, so they feel like, you know, you should be enlightened. You should be above the riffraff now because you're sober like 4 years, right? So, you know, you shouldn't have to struggle with day-to-day problems. I tell guys that I work with in AA, and just so you know, I do sponsor people because I'm asked to, but I don't ever tell them what to do because it's not my business. But I am mindful of this fact that I'm so spiritually enlightened. Let me give you a rundown of how spiritually enlightened I am right now. I'm so spiritually enlightened. Now, I got a nice job that I got to wear a tie for, right? I got two healthy little kids that are super cute. And if you want, I'll show you pictures afterwards. And I got a good job. And I got a good career. I have a house, right? I got two Hyundais. Not one, two of them, right? In working order with all the paperwork. And if I don't go to AA meetings, that's just not good enough. That's how spiritually enlightened I am. If I don't, you know, I'm the oldest of three. Now, my little sister is a wonderful person. She gets through life issues gracefully. She don't have to be told, like, listen, you got to pray and work with others and read all these books, right? So when I start to think that I'm somehow spiritually enlightened all of a sudden, well, that's a dangerous place to be. That's what I call varsity AA. You might know people on the varsity AA squad. I'm not on the varsity AA squad. I'm junior varsity AA, but you might know these people in the varsity AA squad. They're usually telling you what to do and how to work your program. Like, oh, no, listen now. You're not doing that right. And I fired that sponsee. I love that. I fired that sponsee. Now, by my last reading, you know, there's some language in there that says nothing will ensure your sobriety like intensive work with another alcoholic. So when you go fire a sponsee, he's like, oh, aren't you the lucky one? The one thing that's going to maybe save your life, you're discarding that person. I take what God puts in my life, and I do the best I can with what I got, which sometimes isn't that much either, really. Because when you realize that you do have some serious issues, which I do, not only do you become a little bit more forgiving of yourself, but you can become more forgiving of other people, right? So, you know, when I'm at work and someone's like, some jerk gave me the finger in the car, do you believe that? I'm like, oh, it wasn't a white car, was it? Because that might have been me. You know, I say, listen, when people act badly in life in general, which they do, which I can as well. You know, it's not like resentment time, right? Get on my high horse. Let me tell you how wonderful I am, how screwed up everybody else is, or how their program's screwed up. Oh, he's got bad sobriety. Really? To me, sobriety is like pregnant. Either you are or you're not, right? You're just at some phase of it. Because I know in my sobriety, I've had a lot of times where I've had to struggle a lot, and I haven't always acted that great. But I didn't get loaded, so it must have been good enough for me and my higher power, right? Good sobriety, bad sobriety. I'm like, well, there's just sobriety, right? If I'm not drunk today, then I got the same chance as everybody else does who's not drunk today. And I can choose to either do or not do some form or fashion of what is written in the big book. And that's up to me, whether I want to or not. Now, I don't always do it, right? Because I'm not perfect. And that's okay. That's okay, because none of us are. So despite the fact that I am spiritually deficient most of the time, right, somehow I can get to a place in my life where I feel pretty good most of the time. And that is a miracle. That is a miracle. Because I believe, after much reflection, that I didn't feel pretty good most of the time before I took my first drink. Now, I don't know about you, but I didn't get addicted to alcohol because I couldn't. I love the taste of cheap vodka. I loved it. It was like heaven on earth. Wrong answer. That's not why I liked it. Or Old Smuggler Scotch was so good, I couldn't bear to part with it because of the taste, okay? That's not the answer. Like the book says, I drank primarily for the effect caused by alcohol, right? And why is that? Well, because, I don't know about you, but when I drank alcohol the first time, I got the promises. I got the promises, right? I knew a new freedom and a new happiness. I didn't regret the past, and I wish to shut the door on it. I comprehended the word serenity, and I knew peace for the first time. I don't even know how long. I don't even know how long. That's what alcohol gave to me. At some point in time, alcohol stopped giving me something and started taking things from me, right? And I don't know where that point was, or I don't know when I crossed that line, but when I was around 17, 18, I turned around, and there it was, and you can't go back to it now, right? It's too late. And Bill Wilson wrote something. Now, just to be clear, now, I don't think that man was a saint at any stretch, all right? He was a drunk who was above average intelligence, who never really had a job after he got sober except do AA stuff and go to therapy. So, you know, he knew some stuff when he wrote the 12 and 12, right? He knew a few things by that point in time. He'd been sober 20 years, right? And he wasn't distracted with a family or anything like that. He wrote a lot, you know, and he thought a lot, right? And he had some tough times in sobriety. But he says, you know, one of the reasons we drank was chiefly caused by the feelings caused by our defects of character. The same defects I have today, same defects I had when I was probably 2 years old. I don't know when they came in, but they're in there, and they didn't go away. As much as I ask God, nay, beg God, to remove them, that hasn't happened, right? So a lot of my sobriety has been, first of all, learning what the problems are, and then doing my best to direct my resources to managing those things in the best way possible that I can with my limited resources, which generally means asking for help, right? Which I still hate doing. Whenever I meet a newcomer in AA, I say, listen, I'm going to give you my number. I'm giving you my number because I expect you to call. So here's the thoughts that are going to run through your head when you're feeling bad. You're going to say, I should call that guy from the A&A meeting, but it's dinner time. He's probably busy. Or he's got kids, you know. He don't want the phone ringing. It's too late. It's 8:15. He's in bed by now, right? And the reason I know all those thoughts are they still go through my mind today, 18 years later, being sober. When I want to call someone up, my wife, she's more clever than I am. She'll be like, why don't you call Aaron? I'm like, I want to call Aaron? He's busy. It's 8:15. It's too late, right? You got to practice that stuff because it can go away. I found for me spiritual, I don't know, growth, whatever it is more like a treadmill, like walking every day. Like I got to stay up on it because it can go away right quick if I'm not careful about it. Because I've been in that place too in sobriety. And that's a rough place to be when you don't have any tools, really, especially in early sobriety. Yeah, man, what a journey it's been. I am really fortunate to be here. I've had a really nice experience sober when I look back on it. Now, there's a lot of times in it where I didn't think it was so nice, right? I've had a lot of times in sobriety where I didn't think I was going to make it. And The one thing I did do was not get drunk, no matter what I felt, no matter how bad I felt, no matter how hopeless I felt, no matter how much I thought I was at the end of my rope, I didn't drink, no matter what, no matter what. And that's really the only reason I'm still here today. But I will say, to a certain extent, I have done what's indicated in the book at some point in time. You can use that qualifier, the best of my abilities. I don't know what that really means, right, to the best of my abilities. My abilities aren't always that good, right? But for the most part, I feel pretty good most of the time. And I get through life pretty gracefully. And I don't mean like little AA troubling stuff like, you know, I got a flat tire on the way to work this morning or something like that. I mean, you know, when my mom was dying, that wasn't what I wanted for her. But I didn't go to AA meetings sitting there, oh, who's going to come up and give me some sympathy? I didn't want it, right? I thought a much more valuable experience was to be there for my family when they needed me, right? Because that's what a normal person does. They show up for their family when their family's struggling. And to hold my mom while she passed, hold her hand while she passed away, and to think of it as a gift, right? Instead of sitting there saying, oh, I got a call and said mom had a car accident and died, I wasn't like that. And then I didn't have any loose ends with my mom either, because I learned how to make amends, right? I learned how to do that stuff and how to talk to people. And I was able to be a service to her, because now this is shocking, I know, so sit down. But some men don't have a good spiritual vocabulary. And my dad is among those gentlemen, right? And my mom needed to talk about things like death, right? Because she was scared, and I understood that. And she needed someone that she could talk to about that stuff. And you know who it was? It was me. Now, when I went away from my family when I was 18, it was not a sad goodbye, I can put it that way, okay? And I don't think anyone was particularly crushed that I left the house. And I will tell you this, this is what we didn't notice at the time is about 4 days before my mom passed away. And we're in a hospital room, and it sucked, right? It sucked. And she had all this fluid in her thoracic cavity, and they got to drain it. And they drain it by putting a needle in your back and pulling it out, right? It's not a fun experience. And we're all there. It's me, my brother, my sister, my dad. We're sitting there in the hospital room, and it's a teaching hospital. So this is, it's so bizarre. But they got all these people that are learning how to do this on your mom, right? So they said, it's so packed in there, right? They said, listen, we got to do this procedure. We need you all to step out. And my mom says, listen, can somebody stay behind with me? And they said, okay, one person. And she points at me to stay behind with her, right? Awesome. Awesome. That's what sobriety can give you, right? So I don't look back on my 40 years wishing, I wish I would have said this. I wish I would have done that. I said it and I did it. And I'm at peace with it and I could be of service only because I was sober. And that's it, right? That's it. And most things in my life I have only because I'm sober, because the one thing I have learned in AA is how to pay attention to some of the language in that big book. And if you haven't read it and you are alcoholic, it's probably a good idea to read it. It's like 164 pages, which is shorter than the user's guide to my smartphone. So listen, you can pick it up and read it pretty quickly. It's not that long. I find that most people, once they've read it, they don't need much advice. It's in there somewhere. I always tell them, chain of command goes God, big book, sponsor, you know, wife, kids, AA speaker down here. But ultimately, most things are in that book, and there's some strong language in one particular part of that book, which I think, I don't know that it gets its full attention as should, but it's talking about the third step. Now, I heard a lot of talk about the third step in AA and in the meetings, and they talk about belief in God, all right? The third step is about belief in God, and I'm like, really? Now, in defense to everybody else, it took me 5 years to actually learn this and read about it, so, you know, there's no offense if people haven't read the book that carefully on this point. When you read the prayer, it says, relieve me of the bondage of self, right? The bondage of self. The chains I put on myself, right? Wow, that's really strong language. And you know, the third step prayer is the only one where it says, we thought well before taking this step, making sure we were ready. It doesn't say that before any other step. It says that before the third step. Because you know why? It's a big deal, because it's not what you say. It's what it means afterwards. It means you're going to be a service all the time, because your disease is explained to you in the paragraphs preceding that, right? And what does it say about, what does the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous say about drinking? It says, listen, if you don't think you're alcoholic, go try some controlled drinking. That's what it tells you, right? Was this, right? I mean, this is the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, right? But what does it say about our selfishness? It says selfishness, self-centeredness, that we think is the root of our troubles. The root of our troubles. Now, that's pretty strong language because now I do have a horticulture degree, all right? And I was a farmer. So I have some idea of how plants are and their morphology. But you can cut off a leaf and you can cut off a flower. But if you cut off the roots, which stabilizes and feeds the plant, it's a goner, right? So the root of my troubles is my self-centeredness, right? That's the problem. In fact, as it goes to say in the next paragraph, we must be rid of this or it kills us, right? It kills us. So my disease is really fatal egotism, right? I got an ego that's so big, it'll kill me, right? Now, I don't know about you, but I want to direct my resources elsewhere all the time, right? I don't know. I have never been up at 3 in the morning wondering how I can be rid of my self-centeredness. Ever, right? Because really what that third step is saying, listen, you're going to be of service and your only job down here, Mike, is to be as kind and loving as you can, period. That's where what I'm responsible for and what the higher power is responsible for takes over. But that's never how I see it. It's this job, right? It's my wife. It's a lot of times my wife, man. You know, it's the kids. I got to direct my energy towards this or that or this or that or this or that. But very rarely do I sit there and consciously say, this is your ego. You need to direct your energy towards that because that will kill you, right? Now, as a consequence of having fatal egotism as a disease, you don't generally make a good spouse, right? Because when you're always thinking about yourself, you don't do too well with another person in a partnership, right? And I've seen some really jacked up marriages in my time, okay? I don't think I have a jacked up marriage. I don't know. My wife might say differently, but I think we do all right. Like, considering I got fatal egotism, right? That's remarkable that I can be in a relationship with the same person for 10 years, 11 years, right? That's remarkable because that's not what I'm cut out for. Even more amazing is the fact I got two little peanuts today that I'm literally having a wrestling match in my suit and tie 2 minutes before I left for this meeting tonight. Right? And my son's like, Daddy, why do you got to go? That's awesome. Because when you got fatal egotism, you're not really cut out for parenthood, okay? Because if you don't have kids, it's like being a slave, really. All the time, someone else's needs are more important than yours, and you got to meet them, right? I love that when people would say, oh, I don't have kids, but I got a dog. I'm like, oh, yeah, it's just like having kids. If I put my kid in a crate for 8 hours, I go to jail, okay? It's like a dog. I put some food in a bowl and I go have at it, you know, whenever you're hungry. It's absurd, right? But anyway, so I got these two kids. And now, look, I like my kids. Of course, I love my peanuts, right? And I love these two little kids and I like hanging out with them. But I don't like kids. Like, you know, if it weren't for that, I'm not hanging out at the playground. Like, ooh, I want to go push some kid down the playground. Like, no. Those little kids, I'm like, go hug your own daddy. You know, you got sticky little dirty hands. Go hug your dad. You know, but somehow I'm a good father because I'm sober, right? I learn what the problem is and I can be a good sober dad, which is remarkable. And in a lot of ways, my life is like if you took a station wagon and put it out on a NASCAR racetrack, like it'll get around the track, but that's clearly not what it was made for. And in a lot of ways, I feel like that in my life, right? Here I am showing up responsible in my job, responsible in my house, responsible in my two kids. Like, how does that happen? How does that happen? And if you talk to people who are sober for a while, that kind of idea of how does it happen is pretty frequent. There's a lot of times in my sobriety where I look around and I'm like, what is going on? Like, how did I get here? Right? I don't know if you know this. There was this show when I was a boy. It's called Quantum Leap, right? So now, if you don't know this show, the idea is that this guy is getting patched into different situations in life, right? And then when he fixes a right or wrong, he goes to the next one. And it's unfortunately never his life, right? And the end of the show is always the same. He goes in to the next situation, which will be the next show. And he looks around, and there's all kinds of chaos going around. But of course, he doesn't know what's going on, and he doesn't know what his mission is or what he's supposed to do. He has to figure that out. And he's just like, oh, boy, right? And then it's right there every time. And there's so many times in my life where it's like quantum leap in this. Like, I get in these situations. I'm like, how did I get here? I mean, I have been passed out on the floor with my pants around my ankles, right? And then here I am. How'd I get here? It's like when, one of the guys I work with in A is like, oh, life's not fair. I'm like, yeah, thank God, right? Thank God life's not fair. If life was fair, we probably wouldn't be here. Yeah, I'll take luck over skill any day of the week and have no problems giving the credit to something other than myself. Now, I do have a reasonably good measure of my abilities. I think people in AA can go the other way too much. They're like, oh, you know, I'm nothing. I'm like, really? You know, you got to show up. You got to do hard work, right? Give yourself a little bit of credit there, right? It's not easy getting sober, and it's even harder staying sober. And if it was easy, everyone that came in those doors back there would stick around. But if you've been around a while, they don't, unfortunately. Unfortunately, they don't. And I do know that whatever my higher power gave me this gift early on and removed the compulsion to drink from me, which I cannot take any credit for, right? But ultimately, I was the one who went to my sponsor and said, listen, let's get to the steps, right? Let's read the book. Let's do these things. And also to help other people when they ask for it. Because there is one thing I do pretty well in AA is that I don't say no, right? No matter what it is or no matter how much I don't want to do it, right? I answer the phone when it rings. I call people back when they call. For all I know, they might be outside of a bar. You know, who are you? Just be like, whatever, I'll deal with this later. It's like, oh, no. You know, if you can take the call, take the call. Think about, you know, if you're looking for a sign from God, think about getting a call from someone in AA, right? Because you know all the nonsense that went in their head before they picked up that phone and pushed your numbers to call you, right? And if they call you, well, I take that call, right? Because I don't think there's too many times in sobriety where it's that clear what I need to do next. But that is an instance where it is clear what I need to do next. I need to answer that phone and talk to that person and see if I can help them out. And if someone asks you to work with them in AA, now I got a busy life, right? I got a professional career and I work a lot. I work 6 days a week. But I never say no to someone who wants help in AA, ever, right? I'm never too busy for that. Because to me, that third step that I talked about is almost like a contract with a higher power. Basically, I say, listen, I'll do what you put in front of me to the best of my abilities, right? I will take the phone calls when I don't want to. And those happen. You know, you get that call from someone, you're like, oh my God, this guy's crazy. I'll be on the phone for like an hour. Hey, what's up? You know, even though I just put Spider-Man 3 in and I got important things to do tonight, I'll take that call, right? And it's a contract with a higher power. Basically, I say, listen, I'll do what you put in front of me, and I'll try to be as kind and loving as I can, and you'll make me feel pretty good most of the time, right? Because how often have you ever lost sleep over someone else's problems? I've never lost. You can come up to me after this and say, thanks for speaking. I got cancer. And I'll be like, oh, God, that's terrible. And then tonight when I lay down, I'll be right out, right? I'm not going to be up all night worrying about your problems. I worry about my own problems, right? I need gas in the morning. Oh, my God. I can't take boring Lambertville anymore. Like, that's the stuff that troubles me, right? My problems, my issues. And so it's a good spiritual axiom that if I submerge myself into trying to help others with their problems, well, maybe I don't think about my problems so much. I don't know that it's genius or brilliant, but it's a good spiritual axiom, and for the most part, it works pretty well. Coming to AA meetings helps me tremendously. Now, I have moved, I don't know, maybe 12 times in sobriety, a lot. I don't know what it is. It's a lot. But I go to meetings wherever I go. And I lived in foreign countries a couple times too. And I go to meetings there where I can, all the time. Attendance at meetings is generally required for me to feel pretty good most of the time. I don't know why it is. I think because you can go to an AA meeting and you can find people that really need help, right? And we're kind of lucky in this respect because people that aren't alcoholics don't always have those opportunities that are so at their disposal, right? I live in Lambertville. Like, we don't have a homeless shelter in Lambertville, right? But we got AA meetings. Now, I can go to my job, which is very important. Do you not understand this? I can go to my job, but you know what? If I go to an AA meeting, I could save someone's life just by asking them how they're doing, period, and listening to them and not trying to push my advice on them and just, how's it going? Because when you're at your office or the warehouse or the mailroom, wherever you happen to work, and you say to someone, how's it going? They're going to say, fine, how are you? You go to an AA meeting and you say, how's it going? They're like, oh my God, it's over. It's terrible. I feel so terrible. It's awful, right? and you say, all right, tell me about it, you know, because we've all been there, right? There's no one in AA is feeling anything unique or anything along those lines. I mean, AA's been around since 1930s. Like, it's not like the person that comes in is so damaged, right? We kind of help them. My guy, these guys are like, I think I have to go to an institution. I'm like, you don't need to go to an institution, right? Just go to 2 meetings tomorrow. And then you talk to them that night. They're like, oh, I feel much better. I'm like, yeah, it's amazing how that works, right? Yeah, man. What a crazy disease of perception, right? Because that's really the miracle, isn't it? When your whole perception changes, where nothing in your life is really any different. You just see it in a completely new light, which is the miracle. And a lot of people can't stick around until that happens. Because, you know, the alcoholic vision is not a happy one. It's not a pleasant one. It's very, very difficult. If you read the book John Barleycorn by Jack London, it's a good book. It's where that phrase comes from. And now Jack London, who would never admit he was alcoholic, was an alcoholic, right? And writes a whole book about the terrors of alcoholism. And he calls it, I think the phrase he uses, the white logic, right? It's this really nasty way of looking at life. The alcoholics can develop over time, or they have it beforehand before they stop drinking. And tell mom I'm busy right now. I'll get back to him. That's that disease of perception, right? But when you get sober, if you apply yourself to some simple tools, well, you can get what I call the AA big picture, right? Where you can see how good you really have it, why you have it, right? Because it's easy to look back on your life and be like, wasn't it great when? Alcoholics are awesome at this when they're sitting at the bar, right? Oh, man, if we could only go back to that. If only I could be back with that woman. If only this was the way it was back when I was younger. Easy, right? That's not helpful. It's important to appreciate the things that you have while you have it, because then you can feel pretty good most of the time. Because your feelings, I found, are like a very narrow pedestal, right? You only got room for one thing at a time on there. So if you got regret on that pedestal, you're not happy, right? If you got anger on that pedestal, you can't be angry and mad at the same time. Like, those two things cannot coexist, right? So you got to choose, well, what do you want up there? And regret and shame are things that are a part of a lot of alcoholic story. And to me, regret is like, it's like trying to will a different past. I mean, isn't that really what it is? When you're compulsively thinking about something that happened and wishing it had been different, well, it wasn't, right? I wish I would have done this. I wish I would have done that. You're trying to will a different past into existence. That's like me sitting here trying to will a pizza box to show up on this floor with my mind. Now, if I told you I was trying to do that, you'd say, well, you're nuts, dude. All right? You're crazy. But we don't think about that with regret, right? But isn't that really what I'm trying to do? When I'm thinking about something I wish had been different, my ego's figuring all these different avenues, I could have worked it out, but I didn't. That's what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to will a different past into existence, which is really crazy. And how much of my time can I spend that way? Because I can spend a lot of time disturbed. I don't know about you, but I can be disturbed. I mean, you know, I don't even have to be in danger. If you took my adult life in a timeline, right, here and here, and said, how much of this time have you spent disturbed? It's not an insubstantial amount, all right? Now, if you said, now, how much of that disturbed time was because there was a threat in front of you, it's like 0.004%, which means all the other disturbed time was made up in my brain. It was all make-believe, all of it was, right? All that anguish and fear and anxiety was all make-believe. So if by combating my self-centeredness, I can get rid of that, well, that's a pretty good deal, isn't it? Because life is pretty good. You know, you've met people like this. They're like, oh, there's nothing to drink in my apartment except an unending supply of clean drinking water, right? And you're like, yeah, dude, why don't you go read the world section of, like, the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, and tell me how bad you have it, right? Because most people got it pretty good, right? Now, my sponsor told me early on in sobriety, he said, like, you got it made, no matter what I told him, right? I would have very complex problems. This old man clearly did not understand what I was telling him. I had a lot to say to that old man, and I would go on for 30 minutes, and he would listen, and he'd be like, you got it made. And I was like, what are you talking about? I remember when I told him how terrible I felt one time, I was like, oh, my God, I feel so horrible. And he would light up. He'd be like, ooh, you should be excited about that. And I'm like, what? I remember one time outside of a meeting, I was like, I want to kill myself. He's like, good for you. I was like, what do you mean good for me? It's not good for me. It's terrible for me. Aren't you listening to me? But see, he had been sober for 30 years, and he knew what was coming if I didn't drink. Now, I've heard people in AA say this. Now, listen, if it's easy, it must have been God's will. Oh, really? I don't believe anything happens on his plan without the consent of a higher power, right? So I don't pretend to divine the will of God. Those difficult experiences that I've been through, and there have been many of them in the last 18 years, have been the times where I'm growing the most. And when I'm, you know, prancing around happy for a while, that's when I'm growing the least. And so those other periods are required for me to learn lessons. Now, I know that today, right? So when I go through a difficult time, I know that it's going to come to an end at some point in time. Like the Buddha says, all things come to an end, right? It's going to end at some point in time. And I will learn something out of the experience. But when I was new, I did not have that wisdom. The people who had that wisdom were guys like my sponsor, him and his old man friends that I used to hang around with. Now, when I was new, so now I got sober at the end of college, and it was a long, torturous road of alcoholism like everybody else. I grew up in an alcohol-friendly household. That was the only tool I had for a long time. At first, I got the promises, but I sure as heck wasn't getting the promises on my last day of drinking. Right? I had terrible problems with anxiety as a child, and they only got worse. And when I drank, they went away until they didn't. And then they're getting worse when I'm drinking. And that's what the book calls the jumping off point, because you can't see my, I could not see my life without alcohol or with it any longer. There was no place to go, and some people don't survive the jumping off point. But fortunately, I did, because a guy came in and shared his message to my class about alcoholism. Now, he was talking about things like loneliness and depression. I was blown away by that level of candidness, because I was 22 years old, and I lived with other 22-year-old men. Now, that's not a conversation you're having with 22-year-old men, generally speaking, in college. You go up to one of your buddies in college and say, listen, I feel really anxious. And they're like, yeah, all right, I'm watching SportsCenter, dude. Right? You can't have a real conversation with most 22-year-old men. So, as a consequence, this man's openness about his troubles was refreshing to me in a way. It endeared myself to him. And I could understand what he was talking about. Right? Just his ability to share what his experience was made a huge difference in my life. And I had a bad weekend after that, and then I got sober that Monday. And I have to say that my going out drunk was not nearly as exciting as some people's going out stories are. Now, I've heard like cops involved, weapons drawn, you know, chases over state lines. I didn't have any of that. For me, my last drink was as if you took an emery board and you rubbed it across your arm every single day. It was just enough. I'd had enough. I'd had another embarrassing situation, another humiliation, another blackout. And for some reason, it just clicked that perhaps this would be a good idea to stop drinking. And I called AA. Now, when I first came into AA, I didn't really know what to expect. I mean, I thought it was like church because I grew up Catholic, which caused a whole other set of issues. But I mean, I thought that, you know, you went on Sundays and what put it, you know, I didn't know what to expect, right? But I was living in this big university town. They're like, what is a meeting today at like 10, noon, 2, 4, whatever. I was like, wow, some sick people in this town. So anyway, I went to my first meeting and I can't say I felt comfortable in it because I didn't. Right? I didn't feel comfortable anywhere I went, really, when I was drinking. At first, but when I went to this meeting, I remember the first guy spoke and he said he had 2 years sober, and I almost walked right out because that cannot be true. How can you go 2 years without drinking any alcohol? That's like nights, weekends, everything, no drinks for 2 years? How's that possible? Right? I didn't even see how that was possible. But the language that people were talking about was certainly enough that I could identify with it. Right? They didn't dwell on their past. Because I think when you talk about the past a lot of times, you'd be like, oh, I never did that. Oh, I never did that. Oh, I only got 11 DUIs, Zach. I got 14. Right? He's an alcoholic. I'm not. Right? But when they were talking about their experiences, I could latch on to those, their sober feelings. And, you know, they're talking about the big book. When I heard that, I almost was like, oh, negative. I do not want anything to do with the Bible. All right? I gave up my cassock in eighth grade happily, and I have not looked back. Then they said, well, listen, there's this book. And a man went out to his truck, and he took it out of the glove box, and he gave me his little tiny copy of the big book. And I remember reading it, and I was blown away by that book. It was like reading your Friday horoscope on Saturday. And it was all true and all bad. Right? I'm reading, I'm like, oh my God, this really applies to me. I did all this stuff, right? And it really made a significant impact in me and certainly convinced me that I was an alcoholic. Now, I don't know that that book is, you know, there's a lot of other books. I like the 12 and 12, I think. That's a little more kind of advanced AA learning. But that big book really impacted me significantly. And it sets forth the problem and a very practical solution. Because basically, that book presumes you're sober. That book does not tell you how to stop drinking, right? That book presumes you've stopped drinking and you don't know what to do, right? Because that's really what the problem is. Because if my problem was drinking, well, the moment I stopped drinking, the problems would all go away. Whoa, that wasn't my case. I don't know about you. That was like the start of the show, you know? Wow, now I got nothing. I have no tools. I have no alcohol, no tools whatsoever to deal with my defects of character, right? And that's really because then I got to live with myself with no guidance and no idea how to do it. I think that's why AA was so successful, because it says, listen, here's 12 tools. If you learn to use these, you can feel pretty good most of the time. Because if you feel bad most of the time, you will probably drink again. And that's just the cold, hard fact of it. You can slog it out or whatever, but I believe that if you feel bad long enough, you'll probably get drunk. But if you feel good, maybe not. Maybe not. If you like being sober better than being drunk, then you got a real chance at making it. And that was my experience. And when I felt so bad, I went on the experience of other people that told me I would be okay. And I was okay. Now, when I got sober, I finished school and I went down and I was a farmer on the Eastern Shore of Maryland. Now, I joke around about Lambertville being boring, and it is. But now, that area where I live down there, wow, man, it was like a soybean wasteland. I mean, there was nothing down there at all. And I was 22 years old, right? I mean, I don't think it's by accident that my higher power placed me around plants and machinery and no real humans, because that was probably the safest place for me, honestly. Because I had a few issues in early sobriety and a lot of anger, right? I was mad. Who? I don't know. You. Whatever's in front of me, I was mad about it, right? And I didn't really know what I was doing, and I was confused a lot of the time. I work with a lot of new guys in AA, and I find they're in this position. They're floundering, right? They're just like a ship with no rudder. They're just going around in a circle. They don't know what they're doing. I try to give practical issues. If they ask for advice, I will give it to them, and I try to give them practical stuff like get better at your trade, go back to school, right? But ultimately, I was farming down there, and now there weren't any young people. I was young people in AA in my group. And the whole county and the whole like three county area. I was young people in AA, right? So I'm 22 and my sponsor is 68 and I'm hanging out with him and his old man buddies. So after the AA meeting, we'd go out and chew tobacco in a parking lot and they'd bitch about their prostates or whatever. And I'd be out there like, yeah, I hear you. It's awful. I mean, I couldn't relate to that obviously, but I could relate to a lot of other things that they were talking about. And, you know, I really did stay out of trouble that first year, and I worked a lot, because if you're not a farmer, it's not light duty, right? So I was working a lot, physically working. My sponsor called it toil. He's like, it's good for you. He's like, you need to just do a lot of stuff, right, and be busy. And I thought a lot, right? And I did the steps. Now, I can recommend the steps to just about anyone, only because in 18 years, I have never heard one person say everything was going great until I did those steps, man. And then it just all fell apart. Like, I've never heard that one time. Like, no one's ever been sitting there like, oh, the steps ruined my life. Like, I've never heard that one time. Conversely, I am afraid of drinking, and I have heard a lot of people say, I didn't try the steps and I drank. I've heard that a lot. I've heard that a lot. So, to me, I think it's a pretty good idea if you're in a 12-step program to try the 12 steps. I don't think the steps are to be endured either. I think that I almost think steps is almost a misnomer, because it kind of has this connotation that in my house, like if you get to the top of the steps, you're done. It's over. Like you've had it made. And that's not been my experience. To me, the steps are these 12 tools for living, that if I try to do these things, I got a pretty good chance of staying sober, which has been my experience. And if you get with someone that's experienced with the steps, well, then you can get their experience with the steps. Because to me, like getting sober, it's like a truck comes with a whole bunch of lumber and dumps it off in your front yard, and there's a toolbox there. Now, you can try it yourself, okay? You can open that toolbox and, you know, give it a shot. And you may get a house, You may not get a house. You may not get anything. Or you can find a master carpenter and say, listen, can you help me with these tools? And he'll say, listen, that's a T-square, not a hammer, you know? Let me show you how to use these things, right? And give you their experience with it. Because when I work with guys in AA, I don't tell them this is how you get sober, jackass. I'm like, listen, this is my experience with the steps. And at some point in time, you'll have your experience with the steps. But I can tell you what I thought was effective and what wasn't effective, right? And to get started right now, right? Right now. Because now I've heard this too in meetings. Now, this isn't in the book, but it says, now listen, the steps are written in order for a reason. Well, now, how's that work out? So now, listen, if I go punch someone in the face when I got 2 days sober, I'm like, listen, I would love to apologize to you and to promptly make amends for that, but I'm not on that step yet. So you stick around. You come to this meeting in like 4 weeks, and I should be there. Or like, I don't pray now. I'm too busy. I'm not there yet. Oh, nonsense, right? The thing that I did before I came to my first AA meeting was prayed. Now, I'm not a religious person. Even to this day, I'm not a religious person. But it's something happened there, right? Something happened there, and the compulsion came away after about a week sober. Because I was walking around this beautiful town. It was a pretty day, and I didn't know what to do. I was really anxious, you know, really anxious. So I would just go walk, right? And I would walk around. And then I was walking around, and this church was letting out. And I'm like, well, I can't get drunk in there. So I went into the church. And I wanted to drink so bad. I was crying in the shower that morning. I just wanted to drink. And I went to this church and I got down on my knees. And I don't know what was going on, but somehow I kneeled down. And I was like, please, I can't do this. I cannot not drink. It's not possible for me to go on like this. And I can't take this feeling. And all of a sudden, you know, sometimes you get that feeling. It's just like a sense of relief settles down on you, right? The same thing that alcohol used to do for me. And all of a sudden, I started to feel a little bit better. And I remember I stood up. And I walked back to my apartment. And somewhere in that period of time, the compulsion to drink left me. Right? So what am I going to do? Come to AA and be like, I'm sorry, I'm not praying right now. I'm not there yet. I don't know about that. And that's still something I do today. Now, I do the prayers you're supposed to do because the majority of old-timers I know told me to pray from your knees in the morning and every night and thank God for keeping you sober at night and ask Him to keep you sober in the morning, which I do, right, because I'm supposed to. But you know, the most effective prayer for me nowadays is when I just kind of have a conversation with my higher power. Now, I've learned a lot from having kids, all right? Now, one thing I learned is when I come home and I say to my 7-year-old son, what happened at school today? I don't want him to get on his knees and be like, our Father who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Like, I'm not interested in that. Tell me how your day was. Because normally this is what I get. Fine. What'd you do? Nothing. What was your favorite class? Recess. You know? But I mean, that's what I want to have a conversation with him. So the most effective prayer I do, I have a cemetery at the end of my street in bustling Lambertville, and I'll go walk down there, right? No one bothering you down there. I hope not, right? You can kind of shoot your mouth off down there. Or in my car. Now, I do this every morning. I get in the car, and I say, good morning. How's it going? Yeah, what's up with that? And then I just start talking to my higher power. Now, when I first got sober, that looked kind of weird, okay? Because they didn't really have cell phones back then. And when you're just talking in the car, just you, I mean, now no one even thinks twice about it, right? They're like, oh, this is Bluetooth. And you can get away with it. But back when I was first sober, now not so much. But that's the most effective type of prayer I have today. And it does work in certain ways. Not that I ask for things and God gives them to me. Because that doesn't happen to me, you know? I don't think God's up there like, well, because you asked. That dawned on me when I was sober, when I was a farmer. I said, take these deliveries out in the middle of the night, right? And I would sit there and I would say, listen, now, can you please get me to Philadelphia safely? And I thought, oh, well, that's absurd. Like God's up there saying, well, I was going to have you crash into a ditch, but since you asked extra nice, no, I will get you there safely. Like, that just didn't make any sense, right? So when I do ask for things, I ask for Him to help me get through it gracefully, whatever it happens to be, which is enough for me sometimes, right? Just get through it gracefully. And I have gone through a lot of stuff gracefully. When I was a farmer for a few years, I decided that I didn't want to do that anymore. I want to do something else. And I've seen this happen to a lot of people in AA. They're sober for a while. Because you know what? It matters what you do. Now, when I was drinking, I didn't give a crap what I did. As long as I had a paycheck, enough to get booze, enough to let me drink, that's all that mattered. When I got sober, well, that wasn't good enough. I wanted to do something else. Right? So I thought about it. Now, this is new, too. You can actually think about your decisions before you make them and even ask for advice if you want. And I decided that I wanted to go to law school. So I went and applied for law school. Now, that was a massive undertaking. I had been out of school for 2 years. I never learned as a recommendation, right? And I wasn't racking up good boy points before I got sober either, right? So I didn't go to, like, the local homeless shelter and be like, hey, can I have a letter of recommendation? No, right? So I had to go take a test and get letters and work really hard to do it. And the way I did it was just like AA. I did it one form at a time. That's how I did it. And guys I work with in AA, when they go back to school, oh, I can't do it. Yes, you can. Yes, you can. Go to the financial aid office and ask them what your options are. And then they come back and they're like, there's a lot of options. I'm like, yeah, I know. They even said I could transfer my credits. And I'm like, really? That's amazing. I love it when I get when they ask me for something and I give a suggestion and they actually do it. And then later they come to me and are like, did you know that this is available? And I'm like, really? That's amazing, right? You're a genius. So anyway, I'm not above telling them I told you so either, which I do also. But anyway, and so I went back to school. And you know what? I loved it. I loved it. I love going back to school sober. And now a lot of people go back to school sober, and they're like, wow, this is really not that hard. And I'm like, no, it's not. You know what's amazing? When you show up for class, it's amazing how much easier it is. Like, seriously. And if you read the book they give you, it's like, there's like no limits. I mean, it's incredible how good you can do. And so then I went to law school. And then when I went to look for careers, I was looking for service careers. And I went to the Air Force as a judge advocate. Now, I have to say that that was a pretty frightening thing to do, because it's not like you're just going to a new job in your town. Like, you're moving somewhere, probably not a nice place, right? And you're going to be there for some period of time. Right, and you're going to do what someone else tells you to do all the time, because if you've never been in the military, yeah, there's no dissent in the military, right? I learned about that as a civilian attorney. You can dissent, but not in the military. No matter what they tell you, yes, sir, yes, ma'am. Can you do this? Yes, sir, yes, ma'am. Thinking in my head, there is no conceivable way that can happen, right? Absolutely, yes, sir. And, you know, and it was shocking to me, because I went in and I was to become a military officer, and I'm a military officer, and then, you know, then I'm like, you know, government prosecuting. I represent the United States of America, right? And I'm like, wow, how's that happen, right? My little uniform on and all my little medals on there. And then I became a defense lawyer, right? And then I could have really candid discussions with some of my clients, like, you got a serious drinking problem. Like, well, our book says we don't like to pronounce you as alcoholic, but not that we won't. And I had a couple of those fellows where I'm like, you're drunk. You need to go to AA like yesterday, all right? Right now. And try to be a service in that manner, right? And then I did that, which was a very stressful and difficult job. And then this is really a testament to how AA works, because I came out of the service. My mom, I found out she had stage 4 cancer, and we came back to stay with them briefly. And by now I had a baby. And this was in 2009. I don't know if you know, but in 2009, we had some economic problems in this country, all right? So there's just no jobs. And I got a one-year-old baby, and my mom's dying of cancer, and my stuff is in boxes somewhere else. And I felt pretty good most of the time. Now, if you can feel pretty good most of the time in those situations, that's like way more than I bargained for. Way more than I bargained for. Because today I don't have that crippling anxiety, right? I can do things that are frightening. I can go places that I wouldn't go before. I can sign up for things that I never would have signed up for, right? Only because I'm sober. Because I knew eventually I wasn't going to retire that year. I was 35. I'm like, you're not going to retire at 35. And I didn't, right? And then I held out. And now I had a lot of coincidences in my life. Like, when I was in the military, I deployed, right? I did not like that at all, right? But then I'm out there in the desert, and now they got this chapel, and they're like, listen, there's an AA meeting there, but they canceled it because no one was showing up. I'm like, oh, don't cancel the meeting. I will come and show up, right? So I come to the little chapel building, and I show up for the meeting, and for a month, it's just me, and I 3 days a week, I go there, I read the big book, I close it up. So finally, one of the chaplains says, listen, someone wants to come to your little meeting. I'm like, oh, thank God, finally another alcoholic to talk to. And this guy comes walking in, and he's from Flourtown, Pennsylvania, who worked part-time for my uncle. And there we are in the middle of the desert having an AA meeting. Like, what are the statistical odds of that? I don't know. Like, I never do math in public because it's just embarrassing. But, I mean, that's got to be, like, on a magnitude of 1 in a billion or something. I don't know. So, you know, when I come out, I'm like looking for a job. And so I don't know this. I interview at this one place and they have a perfectly nice interview, but I don't get that job. You know why I didn't get that job? Because the firm I'm at now, the position I took, he took that job. Leaving up the position that I got now. And he might wish he was still in my job. How does that happen, right? Meanwhile, I'm sweating over every little silly word misspelling in a cover letter, right? And all this other stuff is happening behind the scenes that I got nothing to do with. Nothing, right? And then, you know, lo and behold, I get this job, you know. It's a good job. I get a good career. I have a good career, you know. I mean, like, I teach other people to do what I do at 40 years old. I mean, now, I don't know how that happens. I mean, I might be dressed better than some of these guys, but nevertheless, like, you know, I'm still 40 years old. And then they asked me to come and teach all over the place, right? All because I didn't get drunk one day at a time, right? I don't say no to anyone who asks. I try to do the best I can, which sometimes isn't that good. But I do tell people, it's good enough for my higher power, right? I think about with my children, because before I got sober, and even after, a long time in sober, if you'd said to me, what's unconditional love? I could have told you what it was intellectually, but I didn't understand it. I'm not saying I never got it, but I didn't know what it was. I didn't feel it. Now I got kids. I do understand what it is. I don't care what they do. I love them, forgive them, like that, right? Even when they drive me up the wall, which they do sometimes, right? And today I do feel that, right? I think my higher power is a kind higher power. It makes a lot more sense, doesn't it? If everyone sitting in this room pulled out their four-step list, well, there'd be some bad stuff on there. I mean, bad, bad, right? But everybody's in here, and it doesn't look to me like anyone's drunk right now. Well, that doesn't seem fair, does it? Unless you got unconditional love, right? How would any of us get sober, right? I don't know about you, but I wasn't volunteering down the convent before I got sober. But I got the greatest gift of my life without even asking for it, right? Because I believe today that my higher power is unconditional love for me. Four steps in this room. Every time I go to an AA conference when there's like 1,500 drunks, I always have this compulsive thought that if every one of these people drank right now, they would have to call out the National Guard right now. If all these people had a fifth of gin right now, this town would burn to the ground, right? Yet they're all there laughing at the speaker's jokes, whatever it happens to be. Like, how does that work? And isn't that a much nicer life? For me it is, right? Where I'm loved no matter what, even when I'm just trying my best. That's somehow good enough. And the evidence is I feel pretty good most of the time and I'm not loaded today. And that is a miracle. And the longer I'm sober, the more of a miracle it becomes. So anyway, I am happy to be here tonight. So thanks for listening. That's all.